Two Sisters, Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. Two sisters leave Norway and travel to Syria to support ISIS. Their father journeys to find them and succeeds, only to hear this from one of his daughters.
She just stands there and says, "I'm not going home." And he's like, she must be joking, or, you know, he doesn't really, you know, believe that what she's saying. And then she said, "I can't go home." And he asked why. "I'm married now."
Plus, a recently released inmate faces a challenge of staying off drugs.
There's always going to be that struggle there. But knowing what it has taken away from me and the time that it has taken away, I've missed so much of my daughter's life already, and she's only 8. I don't want to miss no more.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. In the war for truth, the alleged chemical weapons attack on Douma in Syria is troubling. The Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad says it's all lies and they did not launch chemical weapons against civilians. Russia also says the West is playing with the facts. Pretty much the rest of the world believes Assad did gas his own people. But what have Syrians on the ground been seeing and saying? Moed Duman is a 27-year-old media activist and political science student. And yes, he works with the Syrian opposition, but he was in Douma on Saturday night when Syrian government forces carried out this attack. Reporter Fariba Nawa spoke with him yesterday afternoon as he prepared to leave Douma. Fariba joins us now from Istanbul. Can you tell us a little bit more about Moed? How long has he lived in Douma?
Moed has been living in Douma pretty much all his life. His family started early on in the opposition. He said that they didn't want to topple the regime initially. They just wanted changes. They wanted a democratic society. But when they saw how the regime responded, they decided to become active. And the way that he became active was sort of citizen journalism, documenting atrocities. And his family was massacred in 2012, 33 members of his family. It was a well-documented incident. There was a search in the town of Douma by the Assad regime. It's not clear why. They just basically shot everybody point blank. And he survived because he pretended he was dead. He was shot in the hand, so his injuries weren't too serious. His brother would have survived if he had been able to get medical help, but none was allowed, according to Moed. So he basically bled to death. And he lost his father, cousins. The women in his family, most of them lived, but there were little girls that were killed. And he has a lot of survival guilt.
And how long have you been following his documentation of what's been happening during the war over the past 7 years? Do you trust him?
I trust him because he was, first of all, introduced to me through people that I trust on the ground in Idlib, in the opposition. And every time he has information, he usually sends photos and videos. And when he talks about things, it's not sort of this rhetoric. It's actually just what he sees, eyewitness accounts. And I just got to know him fairly well in the last few days because he's been in touch and he's been telling his story and wanted to share.
So Fariba, tell us what Moed saw on Saturday. What did he tell you?
He told me that he was in an underground shelter when the shelling started. And then he heard several barrel bombs fell from a helicopter.
After that, it was a strong smell. It wasn't gas or chlor. It was a strange smell.
He said there was a strong, strange smell. He said, my friends and I, we usually go out right away and start videotaping and talking to people, but we couldn't because the shelling was so strong. Once it subsided, we moved closer and then we started to see families.
So Moed spoke with you in Arabic. Did he tell you if he saw any victims of what we believe is a chemical attack?
Yes. He had to pause several times when he was describing the scene.
He
said he saw victims, their pupils were narrow, they were foaming at the mouth, that most of the victims were women and children. It was a horrific scene. The smell was extremely strong. The dead were, you know, were moved to makeshift clinics. Most were dead from suffocation. And he sent me photographs that are too graphic to share, but he said that some of them were not able to talk because they were ill, but others who did make it, they did not want to be formally interviewed, is what he told me. They're scared. They're scared the regime is going to attack back. It's happened before. And one of the reasons he's not scared, he says he has nothing to lose. He has nothing to lose.
Do we know if Mouaed is an expert or in any position to assess symptoms of a chemical weapons attack?
No, he said that from what he saw, it looks like it was a chemical attack, but also that the doctor said it was sarin. But he himself is no expert.
So Mouaed is leaving Douma now. What is next for him? Like, where is he going?
He's on the way right now as we speak. He keeps messaging me. He's in a camp right now. He was part of a group that were bussed out. It was an agreement that the government made with the rebels in Douma. Most of these guys are being transferred to Turkish-controlled areas like Jarablus or to Idlib, which is sort of the last bastion of the opposition. And there are airstrikes from the Russian government and the Assad regime on a daily basis there.
كثير معقد لا نعلم احنا ما بنعرف انه وين الامر هلا رح يتجه او شو هي النهايه وخصوصا بعد ما
He said I don't know where the situation is going especially because people are being forced out of their houses. He said I'm calling on the international community to call for people's safe returns to their homes. That's the most important thing. So he's packed all the evidence that he's taken from the atrocities, videos, photographs, and his personal documents. He still wants to continue going to school. He's a political science student, and he just hopes that one day the people of Syria will topple Assad.
Thank you very much for telling us about this, Fariba. Really appreciate it.
Sure, Marco. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you guys putting this out there.
That was reporter Fariba Nawa. Here's something else that's happening in Syria right now. ISIS is losing territory, which means that some of the group's fighters have fled. But many ISIS fighters and the families who sustain them are still in Syria and trying to regroup. Those ISIS families include young women who traveled from Europe to join the jihad and marry extremist soldiers. Norwegian journalist Åsne Seierstad has a new book about two of these young women. They are Somali-Norwegian teenagers named Ayan and Layla, who made the journey from Norway to Syria. The girls had spent an ordinary childhood growing up outside of Oslo, but their mother worried that they were becoming too Norwegian and sent them to classes with a young Quran teacher. The girls respected him. Seierstad says at first the teenagers' parents were pleased that their daughters seemed to be settling down.
They stopped going to parties. They discarded all their skinny jeans. They bought long skirts. They started wearing not only headscarves, but also, you know, more covering. They're starting to become very observant. So in the beginning, especially the mother was very pleased. But then very few people just wake up one day thinking, oh, I'll go to Syria. Oh, I'll join ISIS. It's a long process. And that was interesting to see how that was even possible.
There's this one moment where, it's near the end of the process of becoming these ISIS recruits. Sarah, the mother, discovers that something has happened to the family photo album and the daughters are responsible for it. Explain that.
What they did was that they, in the family album and all pictures laying around, they cut themselves out of the pictures. They let the rest of the people, the family, be there. So there were no more pictures of the girls.
Do the girls think of themselves as feminists? Is this some kind of expression of liberation for them?
I'm sure they don't use that word now, but they did use it when they were early teens. They were quite inspired by feminism. And they even said that dressing in the full niqab, which is the full coverage, they saw that as a feminist act because it was their right to dress up. Because saying that, oh, in the West, women have to undress to get a job and so on, it's our right to dress up. And also when they were fighting for their rights as young extremist Muslims, they were using all the tools we have in the democracy. They were starting petitions. They would go to the headmaster. They would write letters to the municipality, to the county, to the state. So these were really tough girls. And the headmaster, who was a woman, she said she was actually quite impressed. That's before she knew how extreme they turned out. But she was quite impressed how these girls, they did everything she wanted her students to do. You know, if they didn't like the rules, protest. So somehow these two girls, they were standing with their feet well into the, you know, the feminist idea of how a woman should behave in Norway. But they were asking to be stripped of these rights that women have fought for a century or two. Mm. So it's a very confused ideal, I would say, that they were longing towards.
So the discovery of the photo album was pretty shocking for the parents, but the big shock comes one evening when their teenage daughters, they don't come home for dinner, and Sadiq and his wife Sarah get this email from Layla and Ayan, and it's like they've been hit over the head. Can you read that email for us, please?
Sure. Please do not be cross with us. It was so hard for us to leave without saying goodbye in the way you both deserve. We love you both so much and hope you will not break off ties with us. We have already asked too much of you, but we have to ask a favor. For both our safety and yours, no one outside the family can know we have left. Ayan and Layla.
And then Sadiq, the father, holds his face in his hands. And as a parent, I don't even know where to begin to try and understand what he and Sarah are going through. Sadiq, the father, does make this long, difficult journey to find his daughters. He goes to Turkey and hears that they cross the border into Syria. Can you just briefly describe the kind of risks he takes and, frankly, traumas that he endures to track down his daughters?
Yeah, Sadiq is a very special character, and there are hundreds of young teenagers and young jihadis leaving Norway to Syria. He's the only father who goes after them. So what he does is quite seldom. So he crosses the border into Syria, and after a few weeks, he actually finds and pins down where the girls are. He's able to set up a meeting with them.
Take us to that moment, if you would. I mean, he's standing in front of Ayan. The little sister has been hit by a bullet and she's been tended to by a physician. And they're in the middle of this wreckage of war. What do Ayan and her dad say to each other?
So the father goes up to her. He tries to hug her and hold her in his arms and tell her, Ayan, finally, you can come home with daddy. Mommy's waiting. The nightmare is over. You can come home. And she just stands there and says, I'm not going home. I'm married now. And then in the end, she's now the property of another man.
And an ISIS fighter.
Of an ISIS fighter.
Yeah.
Yes, incredible. Definitely. And he tries to kind of cling on to her. And then ISIS fighters are coming to rip the two of them apart. So they arrest him. They torture him. They beat him up. So they put him in prison where he stays for about 2 weeks. But finally, he's released. But he's never seeing his daughters again, ever. That's now, this was 2013. So it's already like in the fifth year that this family is keeping contact with their daughters through chat logs, through Messenger, through phones, but now they haven't heard from them since last year, actually.
And remind us what year the girls fled Norway.
Yeah, so they left October 2013, and that was still when ISIS was still rising.
Right.
So the top of ISIS was 2014, 2015, when the caliphate was as big as Britain, 12 million people living there. They were wealthy. These girls coming from the West with money, they became part of the ISIS elite of Raqqa, moving into the houses of, fled other Syrians or Christians or Shias or Yazidi. And they were sending messages back to their parents about, the great houses they had, a villa, a garden, they had pets, everything they got for free. And they even asked the parents to come down and live with them.
I got to say, it is a totally riveting story. What can you tell us, Asna, about where these two young women are today?
Wow, that is an impossible question because I don't know. The parents don't know. They don't even know if they're still alive. The last time they heard from them was in November, and that wasn't from them directly, but it was through some other girlfriends who were down there too, who had called their parents. Mm. But there's a few parts of Syria that are still kept by ISIS. So there's a few stretches of land on the border between Syria and Iraq. They might be there. They might be in refugee camps in Iraq, but these are run by the Iraqi state, where you even have some of these young women on death row. So this is not a place where you'd be cuddled if you have been with ISIS. So if they're in the area, if they're still alive, they might face a very grim future.
Asna Seierstadt is the author of Two Sisters, A Father, His Daughters, and Their Journey into the Syrian Jihad. Thank you very much for telling us about them.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. This is a true story about beauty and obsession. Okay, that happens to be the subtitle to Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, about orchid poachers and the people who raise orchids. Our apologies, Ms. Orlean. This orchid story is about one man's obsession and about one reporter's desire to hear a really good yarn. It comes to us from South America by way of the BBC's Outlook program. Reporter Clayton Kahn trekked to the mountains of northern Ecuador to hear one man's story about how orchids help give new meaning to his life.
At the rhythm of a surf guitar version of the classic folk song The Condor Pasa, I zigzag my way through the dirt roads that split up the towering green cloud-tipped mountains that define the northern Ecuadorian highlands. I'm going to a small farming town to meet a retired janitor named Alfredo Pantoja, who has a peculiar relationship with orchids.
Perdidos, dan una energía.
The orchids emit a very positive energy. Sometimes when I see them just before blossoming, I can't even sleep. At early hours in the morning, I'm thinking, what color will it blossom? Will the flower be beautiful? Sometimes a couple of days go by and I live with that excitement. I'm not sure if it is fanaticism or what. But sometimes I pet the orchids and talk with them. Sometimes I play them music.
What kind of music do the orchids like to listen to? ¿Qué tipo de música les gusta?
No, más bien les gusta leer.
They like cheerful music. And with a stereo, I put on classical music with the volume low, not high.
Alfredo holds up and directs his handheld 1980s-era black radio towards the flowers. And instead of classical music playing, the same Andean folk song, The Condor Pasa, spews out the speaker. Alfredo spends around 10 hours a day amid the more than 180 varieties of orchids that make up his giant sprawling garden. Alfredo glows with nostalgia as he explains to me that his work ethic has roots in his humble upbringing on a potato plantation near the Colombian and Ecuadorian border.
We lived in the country. In our time, we didn't know what television was. So we didn't have any of that entertainment. We had to work, because if we didn't work, then we didn't eat.
However, nostalgia for rural life isn't what drove Alfredo to his obsession with growing and caring for orchid flowers. For years, Alfredo suffered back pain, but continued to work the fields. He would eventually get married to a school teacher and began work as a janitor. Decades had passed, but finally, the dull pain in his back became unbearable.
They took me to the doctor, and I was told that I had a tumor in my spine. They told me that only one out of every 100 cases would be saved. They sent me to a psychologist, where they told me that I was going to be paralyzed and in a wheelchair, that I would have to adapt and that someone would always have to take care of me. I thought how horrible it would be to be in a wheelchair so young. I felt horrible and thought about my wife, my family. When I went to the hospital, the nurse told me that they would take me to the operating room in a wheelchair. But I told her, no, pardon me, doctor, but I came here walking and I'm going to leave here walking.
Despite his high spirits, there was no guarantee that Alfredo would even survive the operation, let alone walk again. The doctors removed a vertebrae from his spine and replaced it with a titanium one. Alfredo did wake from the operation, but when he did, he was tied down to the hospital bed, unable to move his limbs. However, Alfredo's optimism and determination to leave the hospital walking was fortified by a visit from his nephew and his nephew's girlfriend named Alicia.
I raised my first nephew. He even calls me Papa. He began dating Alicia, and I never met her until she came to visit me after the operation. She gave me a cap with some orchid flowers. I had never seen this kind of flowers before. She gave me flowers which looked like they had patterns on the petals like small angels. The other flowers' petals had images of butterflies. They were identical to the real thing with the wings and all. Those orchids were very pretty. So she told me, you need to believe that you're going to get better. If the orchids die, well, perhaps it's a sign of something negative. But if they continue to grow in flowers, well, then you will get better. She gave me such a nice message that filled my heart.
When I asked what Alicia, the woman who brought him the flowers that day after his operation, thought about his orchid crusade, Alfredo's positive demeanor disappeared.
I have told very few people about her. She had an accident and died. Yes, my Alicia.
Alicita, sí, Alicia
llamaba. Ella se murió. So when did Alicia die and how did she die?
3 years after I began to take care of the orchids, she was coming to visit me one day, and she had a car accident. She was 30 years old.
Ooh.
That really affected me. She was the one behind all of this, a very tragic death. But thanks to her, I now have these orchids.
Just as the orchids were made by Alicia to be a symbol of life for Alfredo, Alfredo now sees them as a symbol of keeping her memory alive. Alfredo's backyard is essentially the Garden of Eden, with hundreds of orchid species, tropical fruits, exotic birds, and there's also his pet dog called Princess. What do you tell the orchids when you're taking care of them? What's sort of the conversation between you and an orchid?
Oh, yo les digo que linda que está mi amorcita. Así, soy loco, soy loco.
I tell them how pretty they are. I'm a bit crazy. I am crazy. I ask the orchids how they are, if they slept well. Tell them that they are beautiful. When are they going to flower? I haven't told anyone this before. But sometimes when I am with them, I see that the flowers move.
And of course, in each of the flowers is the memory of Alicia.
Tanto que le tengo.
I hold Alicia in such high esteem, and given that she gave me the flowers, and given that I made that promise that if I were to get better, I would care for the flowers, it seems that my wishes have been fulfilled.
Clayton Kahn's story about Alfredo Pantoja and his extraordinary orchid garden was produced for the BBC's Outlook program. I'm Marco Werman. They call Alabama the Crimson Tide because they've got a heck of a football team. But does gridiron success translate into more foreign students in Tuscaloosa?
I don't know that they've heard of the football team, honestly. They're coming at me with questions about what is the rank of your engineering.
Roll Tide Worldwide. We've got that story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Our focus for the past week here on the show has been on women in prison and how the number of incarcerated women is rising around the globe. That's definitely true here in the United States. We are the country with the highest rate of female incarceration in the world. And within the U.S., the state with the highest rate is Oklahoma. The state imprisons 151 out of every 100,000 women, according to the federal government. That's more than double the national rate. Today's story from our Across Women's Lives desk takes us to Oklahoma. The World's Allison Herrera met a woman there who just finished her sentence and is now adjusting to the challenges on the outside.
It's a warm and sunny Saturday in the town of Duncan in southwest Oklahoma. So warm that a water fight is breaking out on the lawn of Cherise Greer's tidy house. Cherise, her husband Adrian, and her 8-year-old daughter Angelique are dodging streams of water as each clutches a bright orange squirt gun. This is just the second weekend Cherise is able to spend time with her family after being in the Oklahoma criminal justice system for 2 years. Obviously, they have some catching up to do.
What's your favorite country song? House party?
House party.
House party.
In 2016, Charisse was charged with possession with intent after the sheriff found 3.9 grams of methamphetamines and a set of scales in her car. She spent almost a year at Stevens County Jail before she was transferred to a halfway house. She stayed clean with the help of a treatment program, but now that she's back in Duncan, she's just relying on herself not to relapse.
There's always going to be that struggle there. But knowing what it has taken away from me and the time that it has taken away, I've missed so much of my daughter's life already, and she's only 8. I don't want to miss no more. And I know that that's what it could do to me.
Charisse and her daughter are inseparable. They listen to Angelique's favorite country song, talk about school, and her favorite food, hamburgers. Charisse wasn't able to see Angelique at all when she was behind bars. It was too far of a drive, and Adrian, Charisse's husband, was facing charges of his own, also related to drugs. But they wrote, talked on the phone, and just waited until Charisse got home.
Can I ask you one serious question? Are you happy your mom is home?
Yeah.
What was it like with your mom not being home?
Sad.
What were you sad about? What was the thing that made you sad the most?
Mom being lonely. Mm-hmm. And not getting to laugh so much because my mom makes me laugh so much.
What does she do to make you laugh?
I don't know, it tickles me.
Charisse has 17 years on paper. That means if she uses again, gets a probation violation, or is caught with someone else using drugs even when she isn't, she could go back to prison for 17 years. Charisse is open with her 8-year-old daughter about her addiction because she thinks it will help keep her on track.
I mean, I tell her to this day, she'll ask me, what did you go to jail for? And then for a long time, I wouldn't tell her. But now I tell her because, you know, I want her to know. I will not lie to her. And I want her to know, you know, that if you mess with the drugs, it could ruin your life and it could send you to prison.
In 2017, Charisse was one of more than 3,000 women serving time in Oklahoma. Stevens County, where Charisse lives, is the third highest county in Oklahoma for locking up women. The Stevens County Sheriff, district attorneys, and judges embrace a lock-em-up attitude that consistently gets them votes. The result is crowded jail cells and putting prisons over capacity with nonviolent offenders, like Charisse's mom. Yes, Charisse's mom, Robin Allen, is in prison. She's 4 years into a 20-year sentence, her first felony for trafficking in methamphetamines.
Hi! Well, look at you.
How are you?
What'd you bring there?
Charisse's letters.
Oh,
I awesome. Met Robin 2 years ago when I was working on a documentary about women in prison. Since then, I've kept in contact with her through phone calls, letters, and visits to the prison where she's doing her time. She told me about her crime and how she started using drugs and the guilt she feels for what she's done to her family. In June of 2017, both Charisse and Robin were at the same prison where they had a chance meeting. Robin was out on the yard talking to a guard when she saw Charisse with some other girls headed for a van to be transferred out. Robin risked getting in trouble as she called out, "I love you," to Charisse, who told her not to cry. That's the first time Robin had seen her daughter since she was arrested in 2013. Robin is happy Charisse is home, even if it is bittersweet.
I tell her all the time in letters and everything how we're going to have a functional relationship, you know, instead of being a dysfunctional family like we have been, we're going to be a functioning family. I can't wait to get out and have a healthy relationship with her, you know. And I'm right behind her. I'll be home soon enough. I can't wait to go home and just be there.
Charisse misses her mom, but she's resolved not to look back. She wants to get back on track, and that means finding work and staying clean. Right now, she's without a car and on an ankle monitor, which means she's only allowed out of the house from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on weekdays, and not at all on the weekends. She's not living with her husband, Adrian, right now because of her probation, and Angelique is in school, so she has a lot of time on her hands.
But, like, you know, just her not being there, I mean, I'll wake up and
I don't know. I don't.
Yeah.
Just not having her there, not having her daddy there, not, you know, being in the situation I'm in, you know, not working. So I sit at the house all the time. I mean, it just, a lot of it gets tiring.
Charisse wants to move back in with Adrian and work on their marriage. He's currently finishing drug treatment himself and working full time and taking care of his mom. And she's been out job hunting, including at this Holiday Inn Express.
All right. Now what? Okay, what'd they say?
The manager's name is Connie. She will be in tomorrow, so I'll call and talk to her tomorrow.
And Charisse needs a job. She owes almost $10,000 in court costs related to her case. She wants to have Angelique back full time, and she wants to get out of Duncan.
I have a lot of bad history here. Trying to make sure you don't run with that wrong crowd again or even get associated with that wrong crowd again. Or I want to move away from that.
Most of all, she just wants to have that functional family her mom talks about, especially for Angelique.
Every time, you know, she cuddles up to me in the bed, mama rub my back, scratch my back. I can't do that if I'm in prison. I can't do that if I'm away from her. You know, and I don't want someone else to have to step in and do that when it should be me.
Are you going to try a backflip?
No?
In the month Charisse has been out, she's managed to stay clean and developed a network of friends who can help her when she has a bad day. She's been helping her grandmother fix up the house and started watching Angelique after school now. And she accomplished one of her goals. I checked back in with Charisse, and it turns out she got that job at the Holiday Inn Express, working in housekeeping. That's a huge hurdle out of the way and a small step in getting her life back, despite the odds.
Ready?
Uh-huh. For The World, Allison Herrera, Duncan, Oklahoma.
Wait, can I take my shoes off?
You can see photos of Charisse Greer and her daughter on our Across Women's Lives Instagram page. That's at Women's Lives. That's one word, no apostrophe, Women's Lives. And tomorrow here on the show, we'll hear the story of an extraordinary woman who helped create a new kind of criminal court in Canada. Doris Paul was seeing too many women from her community going to prison, so she decided to change the system by working with a judge to give Indigenous people a chance to get out of the revolving door of incarceration.
They put down the bottle, they put down the drug, the needle, and they picked up a drum and a drumstick, and they're drumming and participating in our ceremonies.
That's tomorrow as our series Unequal Justice continues here on The World. A new twist in the case of the poisoned former Russian spy Sergei Skripal. You'll recall he was poisoned along with his daughter Yulia last month in the English city of Salisbury. Both ended up in the hospital in critical condition. But today it was announced that Yulia Skripal has been discharged and that her father is improving too. Last month, British officials quickly blamed Russia for the attack, which involved a Soviet-era nerve agent. Other nations, including the U.S., eventually followed suit and condemned Moscow. In Russia, though, this case is seen very differently. My colleague at the BBC Russian service, Yuri Vendik, has been following the coverage. Yuri, Russia's been denying they had anything to do with it. What is the latest on how the Skripal story is being reported in Russia?
Well, as for the Yulia Skripal latest news, her discharge from the hospital, there were only fairly short reports today in the Russian media. But as for the coverage in general, that, as you said, that mostly it's been dismissive all these days, ridiculing, and in many cases stating that the whole story is a fake staged by the British authorities, as if it's an established fact. You know, in Russia, there are very few independent media outlets. You know, most of the media is controlled directly or indirectly by the government, and which is most important, the most popular TV channels are controlled by the government. And I want to tell you about one of the reports yesterday by the third popular TV channel called NTV. About Skripal's case. And the report starts with the statement that the reporter says that a wartime-type censorship has been introduced in the United Kingdom, that the media and the officials are under terrible pressure exerted by the government. Then it goes on about telling the story, the latest developments of the story. And in the end, I want to read the whole sentence. I have to apologize. This is my translation, and this is not perfect English. So it says, the report by NTV, Russian TV channel. If Yulia once wants to return home to Moscow to her sister and see her friends and her dog, then her health will highly likely deteriorate rapidly. And then the newspapers will probably report that the British doctors have worked miracles, but alas, the poison turned out to be lethal. The stakes are too high for the British government to allow failure.
Wow.
I mean, that's the sort of reports the Russian TV audiences.
I mean, there's also this odd Russian obsession. Well, they're focused on Skripal's dead cat. Can you explain this? I mean, this was a pet that they had in Salisbury.
Yes, and the Russian embassy here in the UK, it has made a statement and several tweets about the case. And the whole idea of these statements is that by destroying the cat's corpses and by allegedly planning to demolish the house of Skripals, and then allegedly by hiding the Skripals themselves, that the embassy says, the Russian officials say that the British side is trying to destroy the evidence.
Are you personally getting questions on Russia that you find odd or you're having trouble answering?
Well, we all are waiting for hard evidence to be presented by the British side. We don't have it yet. And that's what the questions from the Russian side are.
And as long as you don't get that evidence, are you going to have trouble reporting the story, at least? Is it going to be hard to kind of push back on Russia?
It's not a big trouble as long as you keep balance and you just report what the British side has said and what the Russian side has said and what actually happened. But somewhere deep inside, we all need something more palpable.
Yuri Vendik is my colleague at the BBC's Russian service. Thanks very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
One quick note before we take a break. It's about Syria, where we started the show today, and specifically the Damascus suburb of Eastern Ghouta. Part of Ghouta called Douma was the site of a suspected chemical attack this past weekend. But before that attack, we had for weeks been bringing you voices describing life in the rebel-held enclave. Here's another of those voices, Mohammed. He's a medical student who's been working in Eastern Ghouta through near-constant government attacks in recent weeks.
You have to forget the shelling around you to still work until the last minute. Maybe you will be targeted in your hospital. Maybe you will die. You can't be away from your duty. You have to do your duty. The life in Ghouta is so bad. A lot of shelling, a lot of killing. Every day we have victims. We have died persons by the shelling. And in the last day of our story in Ghouta, the chemical attack happened, and a lot of our relatives, our friends died in this attack. To be a doctor in Ghouta, that means the smell of death is with you whenever you are. I am waiting for the buses to enter because I have to leave my land, my home, and have to leave my city where I burn and live. This is a bad finish for our story.
A bad finish for our story. That was Mohammed, a medical student who's been working in Eastern Ghouta near Syria's capital, Damascus. He was speaking with our colleagues at the BBC. In 1914, Sir Ernest Henry Shackleton set out to do something that had never been done before: cross Antarctica from sea to sea through the South Pole. Shackleton and his ship, Endurance, set sail with 27 crew members and 70 sled dogs aboard. But the voyage came to an abrupt end in early 1915 when the ship got stuck in packed ice in the Weddell Sea. What followed was an extraordinary escape across the Southern Ocean. For months, Shackleton and his men drifted on the ice before tackling raging seas on lifeboats, hoping to reach dry land. Miraculously, they all made it. But the Endurance did not endure. The ship was crushed by sea ice in the Weddell Sea.
The boat, we think, is basically where it sank.
That's Professor Julian Dowdeswell with the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge. He's planning to lead a scientific expedition and hopes to find what's left of the wreck. To do that, Dowdeswell will be using clues left behind by the ship's captain, Frank Worsley.
Worsley made a series of detailed sextant measurements of the precise position of the Endurance as it slipped through the sea ice, and that is where we'll be looking.
Dowdeswell says the expedition's main goal is to study the Larsen C ice shelf in the Weddell Sea. It's one of the largest ice shelves in Antarctica, and also where scientists last year recorded one of the continent's biggest icebergs, and it's close to the last known position of the Endurance. Dowdeswell and his crew will be using autonomous underwater vehicles, marine drones, to explore the area. But he knows that, like Shackleton, he's probably going to face rough seas.
As a scientist who's worked in Antarctica and in the Arctic for over 30 years, I'm well aware that sea ice conditions and other factors with the Antarctic climate can always stop you from getting to your primary target.
And if they do find the ship?
We're not going to actually take anything from it. We're simply going to photograph it, record its present status, and provide that to those likely to designate it as an Antarctic protected area or monument.
Julian Dowdeswell with the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge. He and his team are hoping to find Shackleton's ship Endurance during their planned Antarctic expedition early next year. The University of Alabama football team made their way to the White House today. They were there to receive President Trump's congratulations for winning the college football national championship back in January. It is a familiar ritual for Alabama. The Crimson Tide has won 5 national titles over the past 9 years. This run of success has brought a lot of national attention to the university, and that got the world's Jason Margolis wondering if the team's winning ways have translated into success overseas.
Alabama Crimson Tide, champion season 2017 года. Да.
Those were announcers with ESPN Deportes and Russian TV calling Alabama's winning touchdown at January's national championship game. Yes, most Russians probably aren't following the Crimson Tide football team, but Joe Bonner, a 6-time Alabama congressman who now works with the university, says the team's success is paying international dividends.
The brand is internationally known. It's something that we're proud of because it represents excellence. It represents hard work, determination.
I asked Bonner if he could quantify that. He says 15 years ago, the campus in Tuscaloosa had 20,000 students, mostly from Alabama.
Fast forward to today, we have over 38,000 students from all 50 states and from more than 72 different countries.
The Tuscaloosa campus has seen the number of foreign students more than double over the span of a decade. But how much of that growth has to do with the football team?
It's very difficult to say whether they came because of the football game or because of the scholarship, because of their academics.
Economist Ahmed Ijaz directs the university's Center for Business and Economic Research. He can tell you that each home football game brings the state $25 million in tax revenue, but he can't tell you if any of Alabama's international students were attracted to Tuscaloosa because of its winning ways.
It can be done, but then you have to go out and survey every student.
How about a survey of one? Ijaz is an alum. He was born and raised in Pakistan. I asked him if he'd heard of the football team when he was a kid, and Alabama was winning championships under legendary coach Bear Bryant.
No.
But this is 2018, yeah. The age of smartphones, where a kid in Lahore can watch whatever he wants from the palm of his hand. But would he want to watch Alabama football? Caitlin Kelly is the university's Associate Director for International Admissions and Recruitment. She says when she goes to college fairs or high schools in places like India and mentions the football team back home,
I don't know that they've heard of the football team, honestly. And so they're coming at me with questions about the econ department. They're coming at me with questions about what is the rank of your engineering.
Kelly does say that prospective students she meets in Mexico, Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom are more interested in Alabama's football team. And maybe the students will also soon be engaged that way in China. The university has a guy there now. Hey, Evan, it's Jason in Boston.
Hi, can you hear me good?
Evan Lee does recruiting and marketing for the University of Alabama throughout China. He says prospective Chinese students that he speaks with don't have a clue about American football. Still, he mentions the winning back in Tuscaloosa.
When I give a speech about our school, because Chinese mentality, they're looking for like a brand name schools in the States. The only brand name or famous schools they know is only like a Harvard and Yale and Stanford and Princeton, maybe UCLA, and that's it. So I'm trying to tell them our school is famous in America too, because we have a number one football team.
And when you tell them that, what kind of reaction do you get?
They don't really care at the beginning. However, when I tell them, since we have number one football team, that means we're, you know, well known in the States. That's first thing. Secondly, we made a lot of money. So we can bring that back to our school. We can have better facilities. Our school is a flagship school in America and going real fast and all that.
I see. And what is their reaction when you tell them that?
They'll be like, wow.
Still, he says it's very much a work in progress. But Lee has only been on the job since last summer, and he has some ideas how to use Alabama football. He wants Chinese people to understand that football is a bonding social event, bringing friends together. He says it would help his efforts if more Chinese were exposed to the game, though. Those are Chinese students calling a football game at the University of Illinois. Lee would love to hear something like that coming out of Tuscaloosa. For The World, Jason Margolis, Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Jason's story is part of our 50 state series on how globalization impacts every state in the union and every college team in the union. And that is our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.